Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I'm your host, Massimo Pigliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Giulia Galef. Giulia, what are we going to talk about today?
Massimo, today we have a special guest with us in studio. Donald Prothero is professor of geology at Occidental College in LA and lecturer in geobiology at the California Institute of Technology. He's written and edited 28 books and over 250 scientific papers, including five top geology textbooks. And he's a major player in the skeptic movement. He is on the editorial board of Skeptic Magazine and blogs regularly at Skeptic Blog. Welcome, Donald.
Welcome. Thank you.
This is our second attempt to have you on the podcast. Our listeners may not be aware, but we were originally going to have Donald as a guest in August to talk about natural disasters and catastrophes, and that visit was prevented by the arrival in 1 week in New York of an earthquake and a hurricane. So
delicious irony, yes.
If I was superstitious, I would be staying away from you. But
this is a good reason to change the topic.
Exactly. So today he's going to talk with us about denialism. So I was pleased to discover that a denialist didn't prevent your speaking in New York this
time.
Just
lots of Santas on the road today. So
lots of Santas, yeah. New York tries to keep it surreal, so you arrived on the right day. There are Santas wandering around the streets today.
So, Don, what do you mean by denialism?
It's sort of focused on denialism of science especially. We have so many elements in the culture that will cling to some kind of a pre-existing belief, whether it be a political belief or religious belief, that flies in the face of what scientific consensus has determined in some cases for many decades. And they do this for long periods of time in spite of it. And as the talk I'm going to give this afternoon will point out, they basically denialism ends up having a very similar strategy to deal with the accepted reality of science. And I call it the Holocaust Denier's Playbook, because it's sort of very similar to another form of denialism where people who want to deny the Holocaust occurred have very similar strategies of trying to divert attention and prevent consensus from being reached, even though very few of us have any doubt the Holocaust occurred. And it's not only recorded by many, many survivors, but even the Nazis themselves kept records of it.
You've had very good records, as a matter of fact.
Very good records, right.
So what are some of those strategies that you see in both camps?
Well, the Holocaust and I sort of had a pioneering strategy, which was mostly create smoke screens and create diversions that keep you from paying attention to the central point. And so, for example, when they attack conventional scholarship about the Holocaust in an attempt to deny it occurred or deny its size, they do things like pick at various authors' discrepancy between one author and another, or a small argument within the scholar field of scholarship, and say, "Oh, well, they can't agree on something, therefore it's not real," and denying everything else exists just because of one or two people disagree. Which, if you're in the field of scholarship of any kind, there's always debate among scholars, but they generally agree upon for some fairly large principles or some very large body of facts. And the most common method that Holocaust deniers did very early on, creationists have done for a very long time, and now almost every denier does it, is quote mining, where they pull a quotation out of context from a conventional source and usually chop it out in such a way that out of context it seems to say the opposite of what it is intended to say when you read it in context. And that, of course, is a deliberate attempt to obfuscate. They know full well what that quote means in context, and they're trying to fool people by chopping it in such a way that the reader cannot really tell what that quote really meant.
And they
believe it to be the opposite of what. Yes?
Any examples?
Well, creationists are famous for taking quotes from everybody. Stephen Jay Gould and Ernst Mayr and all the major figures in evolutionary biology have all had themselves done to it. And I've been even quote mined once or twice.
Actually, I have an example about creationism and Stephen Gould. This is something that Duane Gish from the Institute for Creation Research at least used to do. It has done it several times with several people. And that was to present at some point in the debate a quote from Gould, where if you read it as it was, it looked like Gould didn't believe in evolution.
Right.
Which, of course, couldn't be right. And sometimes, you know, one of the nice things about this was a number of years ago, but even at that time, there was already a fairly well-organized network of skeptics, at that time not using Facebook or Google Plus, but using simple email lists. And so, you know, somebody sent out this quote and said, you know, can anybody find it? And sure enough, it was in fact a quote from one of Stephen's books. But of course, it was truncated at a comma. And then after the comma, Gould went on to say, but of course, nobody believes that sort of thing. Now, Gish was in fact confronted with this thing, you know, with the full quote. And his reaction, of course, he became very angry. But his reaction was, well, I can't quote the whole book.
Yeah, but you can have integrity and quote the part that's important.
Well, it was an intelligently designed
deliberately a deliberate mistake of whatever. I mean, they take chunks out of Darwin, which is very easy to do because Darwin often would pose, you know, a rhetorical question about, well, someone might say that this, you know, or this may, this idea makes evolution seem impossible, but, and then the entire, you know, follow up is lost, so that it's his you know, his attempt to show the other position is presented as if it's his position.
There was a great satire of the quote mining practice a few years back, I think by the creator of Dilbert. But he started out with a paragraph from some corporation talking about how great their new product was, and then selectively pulled out phrases and words and even letters from words until the quote said, "We killed Mother Teresa."
Well, yeah, that's not too far off on the way they do it. And you can only assume that either there's a very strong, confirmation bias filter in the way they read something. So they read something and only see what they want to see that would fit what they preconceive, or they're
that
fully
would be the charitable.
That's a charitable, assuming they're not big liars. Or the other possibility, which I think is more likely, is that they deliberately do this because they know most audiences will not make any effort to look up the quote.
But see, that actually is a good question that has come up several times when I was doing debates. You know, I spent 9 years in Tennessee, and I was pretty active doing debates.
I came to visit you one time.
Yes, exactly.
Darwin Day talk. Yeah,
but I've done few since. But especially at the time, you know, it was often the issue would come up and say, you know, are these people actually lying straight through their teeth, or are they deluded, or what? And honestly, sometimes it's hard to tell.
Right.
Because, of course, one of the things that was brought up to my attention at the time, again, within the context of sort of young Earth creationists, is this famous quote from Martin Luther, apparently, that said that a lie is not a lie if it is in the service of God.
Right.
You know, so that right there says, well, you know, it is a lie that may even be aware of it, but in fact it's good because it's saving people's souls. And so that's part of rationalization. Where, I mean, at some level, these people must know that there is something forced in the way they pick quotes at in the most egregious times. But at other times, we all do it. A confirmation bias is a standard cognitive, bias of all human beings.
If you're looking for something specific and you have very clear in mind what you need, you can be very, very capable of filtering out everything else, you know. And so you may miss the next paragraph. It's possible to be charitable and say, yes, they just don't read anything that doesn't make sense to them. And only things that fit their preconceptions get past that filter. Well, if that's fine. It's still a dishonest way of doing things.
Well, the difference there being between dishonesty or, in fact, actual pathologically high degree of confirmation bias. But to be fair, so is it, you know, the word denialism, I'm going to try to play the devil's advocate for a minute here. So as you know, I'm putting together with my colleague Martin Badry an edited book for Chicago Press on the philosophy of pseudoscience. And you are, in fact, one of the contributors to that book. Now, the idea of the book actually got started in response to a now classic paper published in 1983, I believe, by Larry Loudon, who is a prominent philosopher of science, and who argued that the demarcation problem, that is, try to figure out the difference between science and pseudoscience, is dead, and it's a useless exercise, and it's something that philosophers should give up. And besides, let's drop the word pseudoscience because it only does emotive work, right? So, and of course, yet one can make the same argument about denialism, right? I mean, denialism, it does make emotive work, as Loudon put it. What's your take on that? I mean, I have my opinion about emotive versus non-emotive work in philosophy, but what is your take on
well,
it?
Well, I mean, all I can do is go back to, you know, some simple, you know, empirical things about the world. You know, we obey the laws of gravity. We have lots of things about the world we know that we've learned from science, and science is explained successfully. And, you know, we have to sort of come to terms with the fact whether or not we can easily define that distinction between what makes science and scientific method different from other things. Most people most of the time know what is involved in science and technology and what is not. And most people see that distinction without having too much in the way of things, a lot of people fall for pseudoscience if it's dressed up to look like science. That's still a problem. But nonetheless, there's that element where, you know, people recognize science as science. It reminds you of that quote that Rick Santorum just said this week, something to the effect that science shouldn't enter into politics, you know, because he's famous for defending all sorts of positions that are anti-scientific, from creationism to global warming denialism fighting stem cell research, and all for religious reasons, naturally, because he's one of the most extreme right religious members of the GOP pres field right now. And it was so ironic to hear someone actually spell it out that the Republican candidates don't want to believe in science.
That's amazing.
Apparently, Chris Mooney has a new book about the Republican brain coming out, talking about how they cannot live with any science if it doesn't fit their preconceived view of the world.
It's interesting that you know, if anything, one would want to say politics doesn't have to get into science. It's a good idea to keep politics out of science. Which, of course, it's to be fair, it's next to impossible because, of course, scientists themselves have their own opinions and their own political bias.
We're not
bias
a unified body of political means.
But to actually argue that science should be kept out of politics.
My response to that when I put it on Facebook was, he better not go to any real doctors. He can stick with faith healers, and he better stop using computers and automobiles and everything else that technology's brought us.
Yeah.
So, Don, how did you get into writing about denialism? I mean, most of your books have been about geology and paleontology and such, right? So were you just inspired by this kind of nonsense?
Yeah, I mean, it started when I finished the evolution book that came out in 2007. And I got a lot of feedback from that. And it made me realize as I saw this, you know, and I thought, you know, after an inconvenient truth, global warming issue was over. You know, people gradually learned to accept it. We never have this problem of battling against the climate change deniers. And instead, it's gotten worse. You know, the acceptance of global warming from the time of Gore's movie until now has dropped dramatically. And so it was clear that, it isn't easy for science and truth to win out just on its own merits, that it's all about PR, it's all about public perception, it's all about lots of political factors in this case, and especially in this time and day and time. People are, you know, campaigning on fear and emotion, and people are stressed because there are recessions going on. You get a lot of people believing whatever politicians will tell them. And in this case of science, any science that seems to threaten their way of doing things or make things less than I'd like to believe them to be, they will just not want to believe them because they're afraid, because there's a recession going on, and because things aren't getting better for a lot of people. And so it plays on that entire political atmosphere, and it's gotten worse in many other ways. So I started by doing the parallels between creationism and global warming denialism, which are striking all the way down the line. They have almost identical mirror image patterns of how they handle data and how they publicize things and how they critique the arguments they don't want to believe. But there are threads linking them to other kinds of denialism, like the anti-vaxxers. They do many of the same tactics down the line. And there's very strange kinds of science denialism out there, which are deadly. Most people don't realize that there's a whole movement for the last 30 years now of people who deny that AIDS is caused by the HIV virus. And in South Africa, in the 90s, they had a government that had a health policy that refused to acknowledge AIDS is caused by HIV, and millions of South Africans are infected because they made no effort to prevent it.
In fact, Michael Spector of the New Yorker wrote a book a couple of years ago, called Denialism. And I found out about it because in the New Yorker, he published a couple of really interesting articles about the HIV AIDS connection,
right?
In the nihilism, as you were saying, yeah, that is one of the best examples of, you know, pseudoscience and literally killing people.
Yeah, literally killing people. Yes, they're doomed if they believe in pseudoscience.
I actually use it now regularly with my students because right. I teach a class in critical thinking, and one of the first things that the students sort of begin to wonder is the usual, okay, but if people believe in astrology, what's the harm? And right. so I hit them with this, you know, one thing after another, vaccines,
right. and I have a chapter on astrology in this book too, which some of my editors weren't so happy with. So
why not?
Well, because it seems harmless to most people, but a remarkable number of people do stupid things just because the stars supposedly tell them this. And, of course, you know, that column still runs on the newspaper as well as all over the web. Mm-hmm. So lots and lots of people believe somehow the stars can affect your life. It's been something around since the days of the Babylonians. And of course, some of you older generation people listening here might remember that Ronald Reagan's wife, Nancy Reagan, actually made decisions about how the president operated based on the astrologer that they had consulted. So literally, the most powerful man in the world was in the play of an astrologer for some
period. Things turned out very well.
Well, it depends on who you talk to, yes. It could have been worse, I suppose, but yes.
But so back to the idea of pseudoscience, because one of the things that we've been struggling with in that edited book of which you have a chapter is the definition, the very concept of pseudoscience, right?
Right.
So how do you define it and all that sort of stuff? So one of the things that several of the authors suggested, and I don't remember actually if you were one of those or not, so I'm going to ask you that, was that it seems like pretty much everybody agreed, every one of the contributors agreed that it isn't going to be the case that we can come up with a clear, tight definition based on a short number of necessary and jointly sufficient conditions to define science and pseudoscience. That those are concepts that just are not amenable to that kind of definition.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that there is no difference between science and pseudoscience, right? So all of our authors agreed. Then the disagreement begins when, okay, so then what do you do next? Where do you go next?
Yeah.
And so what is your take on it?
Well, I'm not a strict Popperian. I know Popper has sort of fallen out of favor in philosophy of science lately. But, you know, testable hypotheses and the idea that you should have testability and ability to shoot the idea down is still seems to work in most of the real sciences as far as I can tell. I mean, there may be areas that are less amenable to it or less easy to work with, but that still works pretty well for most things. And the thing that really strikes me about things that we classically believe as pseudoscientific, whether it be creationism or astrology or whatever, is that they are classic examples of cases where when there's an inconvenient truth or a testable hypothesis that shows them to be wrong, that's when they go into various kinds of ad hoc rationalizations. The issue, as I see it, is that, yes, it's hard to strictly define pseudoscience and its distinction from science in a philosophical sense, but when you, it's sort of like I know it when I see it type of definition from the Supreme Court famous statement.
Oh, so pseudoscience is like pornography.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, good.
I'm going to quote mine you on that.
Which justice said that, but that was the original context. And because things that we classically always put in the category of pseudoscience, like creationism, like astrology, and many other things that do that, the most striking characteristic of them, one of many striking characteristics, I should say, that tells us that they're not playing by the rules of real science is that they are unable to shift or acknowledge any negatives or defeats or things that might falsify their position. And any time an inconvenient truth comes along that they don't like, rather than acknowledge it, they always use some kind of ad hoc rationalization or justification in some way. And that is, to me, that kind of, you know, completely twisting and bending every fact you need in order to keep yourself exactly where you were at the beginning is something scientists are not supposed to do. Now, I know it's true that scientists are human, and scientists do make mistakes, and scientists sometimes have biases, especially cultural biases they may not be aware of, that may lead them astray. But the big difference between that and what you see in a typical pseudoscience is that they're corrected by the scientific community, by the process of peer review and all the rest. And it's pretty rare for something that doesn't hold up to the scrutiny of a lot of different people to make it very far past the scientific censor of peer review. And that's something you won't see in pseudoscience. Pseudoscience is almost always self-affirming and self-consistent, and they don't tolerate any kind of naysayer or person that isn't telling them what they want to hear.
Don, I'd be curious to get your opinion about some of these borderline areas of science that Massimo and I have discussed in the past. Like, so for example, string theory. I mean, I'm not asking your opinion about string theory per se, but about the structural issue that anyone with enough expertise to say, whether they think string theory is a legitimate science or whether it's just become sort of a self-confirming
right.
thing that can't be falsified. Like, anyone with the requisite years of study in string theory to comment on that is a string theorist.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
Yeah, not being a physicist...
Not everyone.
Yeah, but not being a physicist at that level, I can only go on what other physicists have told me and those who understand it. And it has that aspect of it where it has become almost entirely self-contained and it's built in its own structure, and it really doesn't have an external reality against which most of it can be tested, as I understand
so
it.
So I've brought that up with string theorists, and they've said that's not true.
Oh,
and the
okay.
problem is, I don't... I mean, obviously, I don't have the expertise to know
right.
who's right about this, but it does seem like there's this problem that if you're only allowed to comment on the legitimacy of a field, if you're an expert in that field,
right.
then you get the self-selection problem.
Right.
Yeah, but you remember that we actually have had a guest early on in the show last year, Peter Voigt, who was in fact an expert, as in, you know, he's a physicist who has been working on these issues. And and we also mentioned several times Lee Smolin, who wrote this book a couple of years ago called The Trouble with Physics. Smolin has worked within string theory, and his opinion is that in fact there is no current test
yeah.
nor foreseeable in the foreseeable future. So, I mean, Julia's point is legitimate. That is, you know, what happens when the community of experts is so small and
right.
potentially so intellectually inbred that it's hard to tell, you know, who's watching the watchman, basically, kind
that's
of
right.
problem.
I mean, people say that about climate scientists, too.
Yeah, well, that's a little different, but yeah.
Yeah, no, it is different. I agree.
I think that
the
point being that even in small inbred communities, if they're large enough and there are enough people involved, eventually there will be people who are dissenters. If there's some inconsistency that can show up, and the scientists, by most of them are fairly contrarian in nature,
right.
and they often like to be the noisy exception. They're definitely not, you know, a community that loves to agree like sheep with each other. Most of the time, they're actually almost always somebody who's a contrarian. And I would say that, you know, if a field has enough history and it's got an external reality test against, and the contrarians have not shown anything wrong with it, then I would say that it's probably passed muster, that the peers that were qualified to comment are in that position. And I think there's a big difference, though, between string theorists, which require huge amounts of very specialized expertise for an area that doesn't have any obvious ways of being seen by most of us, versus the climate science community, which are dealing with empirical data that most of us can see on a daily basis, or if you're paying attention to what's going on in the world, you can see that there's a lot of empirical data coming out of every kind that support their position. That's quite a bit different from what string theory does.
And also, the climate science community is much larger than the string theory community, for
tens
one
tens of thousands of scientists.
Right.
I count myself as one. I've written books on climate change, although it's not my primary specialty. So
back to, again, the pseudoscience thing. One of the things that I find convincing, however, is, you know, from the discussion we just had, one might think that other areas that we normally don't consider pseudoscience also fall into pseudoscience. Let me give you an example. For instance, theology.
Right.
I mean, right. One could say, well, you know, theologians, you know, come up with ad hoc explanations and reasoning all the time. And yet we don't. I really don't think we want to say that theology is a pseudoscience. And I think that the difference there is that a pseudoscience is an activity that pretends to be poses as a science. So scientific creationism, for instance, is clearly a pseudoscience because, in fact, it does use the trappings of science, the language of science. It tries to pass itself as scientifically valid. A theologian would never do that. So, you know, a theologian at best is a pseudo-philosopher, but not a pseudoscientist. I'm sure
I can see your point.
That's
it. Because pseudoscience, in my mind, almost all of them have at least some of the trappings of science, and they pretend to make predictions. Many of them, like astrology, pretend to make predictions or statements about the world. But the difference between them and the way scientists do the same thing is that when you actually test those predictions, if they are falsified, they will not back off. They always go to their ad hoc rationalization to salvage whatever they already believe. And most scientists I know, you know, there are lots of exceptions. Most scientists I know, if the evidence piles up and your favorite idea does not hold up, they let go. There's some who are emotionally attached to ideas who can't do it. But by and large, scientists are fairly easily convinced if it's a very strong case against something they've already believed in for a long time. So,
Don, I scanned one of the chapters in your denialism book that's, I guess, forthcoming?
Yeah, the chapter for his book. That's right.
Oh, sorry. It was the chapter, right, for Massimo's book.
Right.
And you had an interesting discussion in there about the kinds of scientists that tend to crop up in the denialists' camps.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Yes. It's the kind of thing where this is yet another symptom of the list of symptoms I give, how there's similarities between creationism and global warming denialism primarily. And in this case, what it is that when they're under attack or when they're trying to promote their cause, what they do is they do this silly game of saying, oh, well, we've got this many PhDs or we have this many legitimate scientists who agree with us. And they give us these phony lists that sound like, you know, they're actually a mainstream group of scientists, or at least that they have significant acceptance among the mainstream. And, of course, the irony of that is that they themselves may not even realize this, but you look closely at the list, and there's examples of creationism all the time of them kind of touting how many PhDs, or they have a book of creationists who write about stuff, and they all supposedly have advanced degrees. But you look closely at what their advanced degrees are in, and a classic example, Dwayne Gish. He was a biochemist back in the, you know, the late 50s, early 60s. You know, he had no qualification to talk about any other field. And Henry Morris, hydraulic engineering. And the culture as a whole does not realize that having a PhD in and of itself doesn't make you a genius in every field. In fact, usually it makes you extremely narrow as a specialist and no real training in other fields. It's that you have to have a PhD or an advanced degree of some kind in the right field and have expertise in terms of actual research experience to be qualified to talk about it. So, sure, he has a PhD. I wouldn't trust him to identify any fossil. I don't think he could if he tried. I wouldn't trust him to fix a car or write a symphony either. He doesn't have the appropriate expertise. And so when you look at these lists of people who deny evolution or lists of global warming deniers, it's always called from a subset of people who have no actual qualifications or formal training in the field. And it always sounds impressive. You know, a bunch of physics PhDs may be great, but they don't tend necessarily know much about evolution and certainly don't know that much about climate change. And yet that's the largest body of these people on these lists. And then, hang on, I'm going to finish the thought. The frustrating thing about this is these lists look really impressive to the uninformed. And in political, you know, their political football, James Inhofe, Senator of Oklahoma, has used them on the floor of the Senate to push the global warming denialism. But the NCSC did one of the best satires and put downs of that whole thing. Some of you out there probably know there's a thing called Project Steve on their website. And Project Steve, which is showing
that would be, I'm sorry, the National Center for Science Education.
NCSC.org, I believe. You go there, and Project Steve, to show how ridiculous these counting, you know, creationists who have PhD lists are, they have a list of just scientists who are accepting evolution, whose names are Steve, Stephen, Stephanie, or any cognate thereof. And that's well over 1,200 or something like that right now. And that's one name that's like less than 0.1% of the names in the English language. And so if you just scale that up right away there, that's more than all the creationists' PhDs put together.
So you were talking in particular in this chapter about nuclear physicists being sort of overrepresented in...
Right. That's another thread, yes.
Yeah, so you had an interesting explanation of...
Right.
Why nuclear physics in particular?
It has actually an interesting historical background. And it's from the Cold War. And there's a very good book out there I highly recommend to everybody. Just came out a year or so ago now, called Merchants of Doubt. And it's by Naomi Oreskes, who's a philosopher in history of science at UC San Diego, and Eric Conway, who works at JPL. I've met them both. And came out about a year ago, and it beautifully goes into, and they did a tremendous amount of research and legwork, tracking down documents of all sorts of government sources and everything else, of showing where this comes from and who these people are and where they're qualified. And it turns out that it all roots back to right at the end of the Cold War, end of the phase of the Cold War. There were a series of scientists with mostly right-wing political views, you know, strong anti-communists, almost all of who were involved in nuclear physics because they were cold warriors. They actually built bombs or they worked on some program that was related to it. And then when the Cold War ended, even before it, they began to do things to defend their world viewpoint and their position. So it's Fred Seitz and it's Robert Jastrow, a few others, just four or five individuals are at the base of every one of these little denialist groups. And while the Cold War was still going on, for example, they were very active fighting against Carl Sagan and the movement to reduce nuclear warheads because this is the time when Reagan was trying to push his so-called Star Wars initiative, and so they tried to push back. When the Cold War ended, they don't have any communist boogeyman anymore to fight against, so then they decided to transfer their energies and attentions to fighting anybody who would restrain capitalism. So they become very tightly linked with libertarian types of institutions at this point. Or anybody would stop, you know, tobacco companies from doing whatever they please, or polluters from doing whatever they please. In other words, anybody should do anything as long as, you know, they don't restrain capitalism. So they then became the root source for a tremendous amount of all this denialist work, whether it be denying global warming or denying whatever. Even, you know, they had a tremendous influence on the group who did try to fight against the ozone hole issue. And ironically, in spite of their efforts, the ozone hole issue was resolved. And the companies that made chlorofluorocarbons were all capable of switching to alternatives. The market had already shifted away from them. Mm-hmm. And so we now have a global agreement on those things. And we are actually gradually recovering our ozone layer. So it was actually scientifically resolved. And in spite of that, these guys were always fighting against the what was going on in science.
One of the things that strikes me as interesting is how actually old these debates are. And I really mean old. Because, so for instance, as it turns out, the first discussion I can think of in the Western canon of pseudoscience, although the term certainly wasn't used at that time, it's found in one of the Platonic dialogues, the Charmides.
That is old, yes.
When Socrates actually inquires about the difference between quackery and medicine.
Yeah, because that has a similar parallel, right?
Yeah.
The quacks were known to be frauds from the very beginning.
And the Socrates' conclusion at the time was, look, the only people that can tell the difference are actual doctors. Yeah. you gotta ask the experts.
And of course, now we know about medicine at that time, none of them were doctors in any modern sense.
So. Right. But now, if the term pseudoscience itself apparently actually traces back only to 1843. It was a physiologist, François Magendie, who used it. And interestingly, it used it in the context of discussions or criticisms of phrenology.
Oh.
And so, you know, phrenology at the time could have made an interesting case for being actually a science.
Right.
Clearly, it's not. You know,
it's very popular at that time, though.
It was very popular, and you know, there seemed to be empirical evidence and that sort of stuff.
Right.
But in fact, even as early as 1843, somebody said, no, this is actually pseudoscience, and he actually used the term pseudoscience.
That was en français, I assume, right?
Yeah. So investigations, of course, of systematic investigations of pseudoscience also have a long history. Probably most of our listeners are familiar with the episode in 1784 when King Louis XVI of France convened that special team that included Benjamin Franklin and Antoine Lavoisier to investigate and eventually debunk mesmerism.
Yeah,
which
mesmerism
was
hugely popular at that time, yes.
So it's not going away.
No.
We're talking 2,400 years of history here.
That's right. No, I doubt that it ever would either. I mean, it's in the nature of humans to believe whatever makes them feel better. I mean, I think that's the simplest truth behind it, that people, you know, in every culture have their own stories about the world, and the stories about the world to a greater or lesser extent are things that either help them understand it or cope with it or feel better about their role in it, especially reducing the fear of the unknown. And it's always, you know, that's driven mythology from the very beginning as well. And I doubt that ever will change because humans are still humans. What differs, though, is that the stories about the world the scientific community has produced, many of them produce testable consequences. Many of them produced the technology that we're using to make this broadcast right now, unlike anything in the last four millennia. You know, there was no progress on electronics or physics or medicine until modern science came along. And I, you know, when someone says this, you know, ridiculous thing, we should keep science out of politics, or we should keep science from interfering with religion, I say, okay, well, you can go back to faith healing. You can go back to the way doctors were back in the 19th century when it was probably better not to have a doctor come because he probably would bleed you and probably pass germs to you rather than leave you alone. That's how homeopathy got started. The reason they were so successful early on is because it was actually more dangerous to see a doctor than not see a doctor. And the homeopaths didn't do anything.
Right.
They didn't deal with open wounds or pass germs to patients so easily, and therefore they got to be the better survival rate, and that's the only way that got started.
They helped by not hurting.
That's right. But of course, then modern medicine changed, and homeopaths didn't. So,
Don, do you have any practical advice from your experience in talking to denialists? Like, if evidence doesn't change their mind, then what does?
Yeah, it varies on who your audience is. I mean, there's always a core of people in the creationist movement, a core of people in the, you know, the global warming movement, you know, have very strong held beliefs, whether it be a libertarian route for the denialists in global warming or a religious route for the creationists. And those people are, you know, virtually impossible to reach because that that philosophic underpinning of it gives them the sense of meaning of life and sense of security and something that they don't want to surrender. That's why it's impossible almost ever to root that out. So in my 2007 books, I specified cases where Dwayne Gish had told demonstrably false information. And in that context, I expected some response from the creationist community. In fact, they ignored it for the first 2 years, and I realized they don't read anything other than what already reaffirms their position. But what was really heartening to me, I don't expect to read those people ever. That's just not going to happen. What was really encouraging to me, especially as I saw the sales of that book take off, and I began to read the comments that put on there on the Amazon site, which is a really good barometer what the general readership is saying out there, was it was really useful for people on the fence, on the borderline. People who had heard something about evolution but were also from a religious background, or people who were confused about it and weren't sure what to think. So they weren't sold on a pure creationist position, but they also weren't sure what they should think or not think about evolution. And that audience was overwhelmingly positive. Yeah. That was the kind of people I didn't expect, but I realized there's a large percentage of Americans don't really have an opinion, and thanks to our poor high school educations, don't know anything, that really didn't know what was going on, what evolution was about, and why creationism was wrong. All this stuff I tried to lay out in as simple a fashion without offending anybody other than people who already don't want to hear it. And I apparently reached that audience. And I think that same would be true of any of these cases. There's going to be the hardcore believers, and only time and political and social change will probably diminish their numbers. But I doubt they'll disappear completely. Just like creationism has never vanished from American politics ever since evolution came along. But on the other hand, they're only a small percentage. Most of these people that Gallup keeps getting 40% of Americans are creationists, I don't think are hardcore. I think they just don't know any better, and they may not have heard anything. And so I think there's a great undecided middle in America that you can reach if you give them persuasive arguments and are very direct about why the opponent is telling a false story.
What you're saying actually is very consistent with a very recently published little handbook. It's called The Debunking Handbook by John Cook and Stephen Levadonsky. Yeah. We'll put a link on the website because I highly recommend it. It's a small 8 pages.
Oh, wow. But it's very
based,
useful.
Yeah. And it's based on essentially cognitive psychological research, right, that tells you what works and what doesn't work. And one of the things, of course, that they do say is exactly what you just said. That is that, forget about, convincing or approaching the true believers, just go for the middle. Another thing, however, that I thought was into two interesting things that I thought these authors point out is that research shows, first of all, that a lot of factual information actually has a deleterious effect.
Right. I've read about that too.
That if you don't want to just bombard people with fact and fact and fact, right, because apparently what the brain does, if you ask people immediately,
right,
after they heard the facts, they may be able, in fact, to basically spit it back out. But later on, if time passes, what they're left with is the fact becomes a hazy, foggy kind of thing, and the myth that which you wanted to debunk actually remains. And so, in some sense, you're actually doing the opposite of what you should be doing. The other thing that these authors point out of the debunking handbook is that you don't want to actually mention, if possible, the thing you are debunking.
I read about that too.
Because if you mention, especially if you mention it at the beginning, actually this has a reinforcing effect rather than a debunking one.
Right. I don't know exactly how that would, one way or another on that, because in my book, it's deliberately, one thing I deliberately did with my 2007 book, and I did somewhat with the book I'm working on now, is you can't leave the the monster in the closet unmentioned. And so most of the thing I was frustrated with, I looked at other books on evolution that were out there, mostly written by biologists, was that not only creation not mentioned, but no attempt was made to even give them some kind of a little bit of tidbit of reason why we don't even bother to think about creationism in serious science. And I felt, okay, there's definitely got to be a market for something that actually faces it head on, because it is such a huge issue in the culture, and there's so many people have gotten in the middle of these debates and had things happen where they were suddenly faced with the two sides and didn't know what to make of it. And that's what I felt my book had a niche for, and apparently it did the way it sold. Yes, it may not be helpful to you may be better if you just present them your side in a very persuasive thing in many contexts, but so many people were doing that and not making any progress. I felt here's the time to actually put the whole debate out and show them why the opponent's position is this, And here's the answer to it. And of course, well, those answers have been out there a long time.
Let me give you an example. So from the handbook, actually, they provide a schematic example, which applies to something we were discussing earlier, the climate change controversy, right? So they have this nice little diagram where they start out, they show you how to present more effectively, you know, your arguments. And so they start out with the core fact is communicated in the headline. And in this case, the example is 97 out of 100 climate experts agree humans are causing global warming.
Right.
Then they go on with a core fact being reinforced in the opening paragraph, and you flesh it out. Then you give, and this is apparently crucial, then you give an explicit warning, cueing the reader that the myth is about to come up.
Yes.
And so the way they phrase it is, you know, however, movements that deny a scientific consensus have always done blah, blah, blah. Then you actually state the myth.
Right.
The myth in this case being that the petition project that you were talking about earlier, where a bunch of, you know, 31,000 scientists disagree.
Yes, the Oregon petition. Sort of I know the story in there quite well.
And finally, they conclude by using graphic where they actually show you that out of those 31, you know, that what does it mean to have 97% agreement? So they have this nice diagram where there's a bunch of tiny little people each representing a scientist.
Yeah.
And then they have a circle around the only one that disagrees on this thing. Based on the idea that graphic information actually remains, you know, it sticks with your mind much
worth
more.
A thousand words.
In this case.
In that vein, probably every time that you refer back to the myth that of the petition, you probably want to use the word myth instead of saying the claim that or the idea to like keep reinforcing in people's minds.
Well, that's sort of the structure of my evolution book and my upcoming book, is that I, you know, usually start with here's what the consensus is, and then I, you know, after I've framed it and explained it as clearly as I can, then I will go over to the, you know, I don't usually start with the opponent's position first.
Yeah.
You know, that's not something you don't want to do.
Other
than you, I'll start anecdotally, maybe with a politician making a stupid statement along the lines we were just talking about, just an illustration of where it is in the culture, and then start with the science, and then eventually come back to the.
I mean, these effects are subtle. When I was doing research for Nonsense and Stilts, I found, for instance, literature in psychological literature that shows that a very effective way of smearing a candidate is to publish a disclaimer.
Yes.
Of a lie, right? So, you know, like Don Prather, who is now running for, you know, vice president or whatever, did not have an affair or
when
something.
When did you stop meeting your wife? Yes.
Yes. Right. And the denial itself eventually gets sort of dropped out of people's memory.
Right.
And what remains is the association between the name and, and the deed.
And then, of course, in the literal sense, your ad did not, in fact, say something false.
Exactly.
So you are not up against the wall there. So.
Human beings are bizarre.
These are called by some people, I know, the dark arts of psychology.
It's a dark side.
Yeah, so the way we've been manipulated in many more ways than we really want to admit.
Well, I mean, the whole idea of propaganda is applied psychology. And,
finding a way to get
past
humans.
It could work either way.
Right. Humans, a little bit of rational filter, which they don't usually use most of the time anyway. So,
on that optimistic note, we will wrap up this section of the Rationally Speaking podcast and look forward to hearing your pick. I would just like to let our listeners know that if you're interested in discussing this or any of our other Rationally Speaking topics further with Mira Massimo, I encourage you to come see us live in all of our rational glory, because Massimo and I are both going to be at the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, the fourth annual, this coming April 21st and 22nd in New York, New York. Massimo and I will be taping a live episode of Rationally Speaking. And as a nice extra bonus, in addition to the two of us, you get a great lineup of fascinating speakers and panels and performances from people like James Randi, Seth Shostak, Joe Nickel, the SGU crew, and many more. Go to nexus.org, that's NECSS.org, and get your ticket now, because we do expect to sell out.
Welcome back. Every episode, Julia and I pick a couple of our favorite books, movies, websites, or whatever tickles our rational fancy. This time, we ask our guest, Don Prather, for his suggestion. Don?
Yeah, I'm thinking about possibilities here, and I have a weekly blog on skepticblog.org that appears every Wednesday morning. And so if you're interested in the kinds of things that I like to work on, whether it be scientific topics, evolution, climate change, frequently it's a philosophical topic, This week's blog is about John Lennon in the 60s, because this is the anniversary, or 2 days ago was the anniversary of his death here in New York City. So I try to post something that's a little more than just what I did with my last 24 hours type of blog. And, a lot of them are fairly interesting philosophical or scientific topics. The one 2 weeks ago was about the famous story of the Nebraska man tooth, which is one the creationists beat to death all the time. And I just saw that specimen yesterday when I was in the American Museum. So I put a little story together about how that came to be and who made the mistakes and then how creationists have abused that. So that's the kind of stuff I try to post every week, and it's going just fine. In fact, I'm already post enough to get through February at this point. So
wow.
I had a lot of ideas when I just started last March, right after my book came out in the Sendai quake, and I wrote a bunch of things that people wanted to use. So I thought, okay. Well, then they asked me to be on this skeptic blog post with Michael Shermer and Brian Dunning and Daniel Loxton, a number of different other contributors, Steve Novella. And I figured my perspective is a little different because I'm more of a natural scientist, not a doctor like Steve Novella is. So I post on topics that are mostly in the scientific and natural sciences. And it's been fun to watch the different responses. The thing that's the most interesting about it, it has a very active comment string that picks up on almost every post. And all I have to do is mention anything that has to do with politics or anything close to infringing on libertarianism. And then there's a giant... usually it's a snowballing string that goes way out of control and has no bearing to whatever I said. But the lefties versus the libertarians usually go at each other for 50 or 100 comments after each show.
Yeah, I noticed that. In fact, I developed that into a trick. Anytime that the Rationally Speaking blog sort of feels like it's not getting enough hits, then all I need to do is to
bring
mention
that up, yes.
Libertarians.
Because
all of a sudden it spikes.
Probably the one big divide in the skeptical community is there are a lot of libertarians,
right. Exactly.
Who are sort of the conservative side, and then a lot of liberals. And so that always gets interest, and I don't usually intend that, but I discovered by accident every time I mention global warming, it always lapses into a battle of libertarian versus liberal view of how that we face it. But I'm trying to talk about the science, so that's the interesting way it gets completely out of
there. And as we said earlier, you better not get the science into the politics. So.
According to Santorum, of course, yes.
I can't believe you have enough blog posts already written for February.
Well, every time I have an idea and I have time to do it, I try to write it while it's hot. And get it there, because I'm going to be very busy in the next few months, and I'm doing a lot of different things at once. I'm just finishing a sabbatical right now, so I'm writing like a maniac right now. And so when I'm not writing on a book that I've – a couple books I just finished, then I try to put posts in there, because then I figure, okay, I'll be in the middle of teaching, or I'll be in the middle of something else. I won't have time, and I won't have an idea. So if I got an idea, you can upload them at any time. And then so I keep uploading them and put dates on them in the future. And then what ends up happening is something will happen that particular week that I'd say, oh, I should comment on this. So then I'll bump one that's not time sensitive to February or March, because I want to comment on what just happened. And so that's why it keeps
Julius,
so
this is the way to do it. So I'm waiting for your next six posts for Rationally Speaking. I like to have them by tomorrow night, if possible, please.
Well, I have enough blog posts written for last week, so February.
Well,
it
was also because I've done a book and everything. A lot of the pieces of books I've written end up being nice little tidy stories that fit as a blog post.
Right.
So
cool. Well, everyone, I encourage everyone to check out Skeptic Blog for Don's posts and some other great posts by the fellow contributors to the blog, as well as his chapter in Massimo's book, which is going to be coming out soon, and a little farther down the line, Don's own book on denialism, covering many of the topics that we discussed today in the podcast. Don, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks
on the show
for inviting
today.
Me. It was great.
And as always, links to all of the websites and books and so on that we've mentioned in this episode will be on our website, rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.